When my oldest child, Noah, was in junior high, an unfamiliar panic swept over me. I had only ever homeschooled to that point, but as I was staring high school full in the face, I suddenly doubted everything I had learned and everything I had done. I wondered, do I have what it takes to homeschool him all the way through high school? After all, I was terrible at math. My own high school math career was famously poor. I wondered if I could provide him with the foreign language instruction that was required to get into college. And I worried that perhaps my style of home educating wasn't really preparing him for due dates and grades and the pressures associated with college. So I found myself at this critical juncture called the re-upping moment. We had built this beautiful homeschool together that was filled with joy and activity and deep dives into learning. But what about all those pesky credits? How would I incorporate those into his life? Today's guest, Karen Goldstein, presents us with this exact dilemma, and she is such a delight to talk to. Karen's got a lot of insight into what it takes to create a great life of learning for her teen, but she's also being nagged by those same doubts. What about? What about? So that's what we're going to talk about today. Can't wait for you to join me on this season's episode 7 of the podcast. Welcome to today's episode of the Brave Writer Podcast. With me today is Karen Goldstein, a homeschooling mother to her 15-year-old son, Elijah. They live in Northern California with their poodle named after the amazing poet Rumi. They also have 4 chickens that are each named after great historical women. Karen has a background teaching elementary and high school English. She was also a writing fellow with the Cal State Long Beach's writing workshop program. So awesome. When her son Elijah turned 3, Karen realized she wanted to homeschool him. She didn't want to leave him in the school system. And thus began their learning adventure together. Karen wrote to Ask Julie, looking for advice about how to balance a high school homeschool life with a love of learning. Karen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. I think your question is one that both intrigued me and I am sure will resonate with a lot of parents, especially parents of high schoolers. So can you put it into your own words? What is it that you would like help with in your homeschool?
Well, right now I'm really struggling with Elijah entering high school. There are more classes and more subjects and more expectations. So trying to balance the rigor of high school level work with what we used to have, which was a much more laid back homeschooling lifestyle and real excitement in learning.
That totally makes sense. How do you see the current level of high school work inhibiting that? Why doesn't it feel similar to what you experienced before?
There's just a lot more of it.
Give me an example of what a lot more looks like. What does a day in the life of Karen and Elijah look like?
Well, let's see. Today, Elijah's in the other room waiting for a response from his Brave Writer instructor so he can get started with that. He'll spend probably an hour and a half doing some Brave Writer work. He has foreign language. He's got a class at the community college for math. We'll run some errands. You know, all of those things are taking really the amount of time of a school day. He's got some history reading. You know, these are, it feels more like a day at school.
Yes.
Rather than maybe what we did, you know, a long time ago, which is go collect leaves and flowers and dissect things and, you know, take a nature walk and what else would we do? You know, sit down on the couch and read a novel together, you know, a few chapters. So we're still squeezing in something like listening to the audio of The Lord of the Rings while he does chores in the morning, emptying the dishwasher and,
right.
And, you know, that kind of thing, but it's, but it feels really different. There's just a lot more and things that used to be in the forefront, like daily reading time for the two of us together, or field trip time, or, you know, nature walks, those kinds of things really are taking a background. And so I think part of that's just a normal transition into high school level work, adulthood kind of level expectations, you know, prepping for college. But it's also that it's so much more time in the day that I'm trying to figure out how to balance adding those other fun things in, or just accepting, hey, this is where our life is now, and this is the direction we're in.
Does Elijah share this similar feeling about the way his life is, or does he feel satisfied with the way it is? Has he voiced any concerns or, you know, wistful longings to you?
He asked, I think it was about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, about, you know, some of the new things we were adding to his schedule. We had always talked about really, you know, loving learning and loving everything we do. And he says, you know, Mom, I don't love this thing, whatever it was we were working on. Mm. Is this how it's going to be? And I said, well, some things we're really just going to have to do. And so I remember that conversation. Taking on a charter school has changed the flavor of our homeschooling a bit, because they are expecting certain classes to be covered, more subjects to be covered. And so, you know, we're considering whether or not to stay in for the long term, you know, through high school for that reason.
These are good questions. Yeah. Yeah. And I think what you're describing is that uncomfortable shift from when kids are young and exploration seems to be the characteristic of homeschool. And then it shifts in high school sometimes to checking off credits or completing coursework or prepping for the future. It has a less immediate feel sometimes. It feels like we're getting through or getting done rather than engaging the subject. Do you have that sense?
Right. Sometimes that's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he definitely has goals. He'd like to be a pilot.
Love
and that takes, you know, that takes a level of commitment. He'd rather, if he does need to check off boxes, he'd rather during high school get some college credit for it. So he started at the community college with a couple of classes. So he feels like some of it is really working toward his ultimate goal. Of being a pilot, but it is also some of that, especially with the charter school, checking off a lot of boxes.
So one of the things that I thought about while I was considering his aspiration, first of all, he's lucky to have a clear aspiration. A lot of kids at that age are still very much in the exploratory period, don't know exactly what they want to do with all this education. The fact that he's able to have that laser focus helps him work through the classes that maybe are less interesting or less exciting than his usual work or the things he remembers from when he was younger. That said, we want him to continue to experience his own life as being pleasurable, not just being a series of, you know, drudgery steps toward this piloting license. Has he begun work on getting his private pilot's license? Because I know you can actually fly while you're a teenager. You don't have to wait till adulthood.
Right. So he wanted to get his driver's license first.
That sounds logical.
Which is logical, right. So so in a few months, he gets to start driver's training. I'm breathing deeply.
Nice. About that.
I think more worried about him being in a car than him being in a plane.
Understood.
And then we're involved in something called a Young Eagles program, which once a month he gets to fly with the Young Eagles chapter of the EAA, which is a pilot association. My brother-in-law takes him up once a year. Elijah gets to plan the flight, and that's his big birthday present. So we've been all over Northern California, over the Golden Gate Bridge, and down to Monterey and Half Moon Bay, and you know, up over Napa with Elijah steering, you know, piloting. And so we're working. He's read the flight manual, pilot's handbook, and a bunch of other books about communicating as a pilot, you know, things like that. So I'm always bringing in books. You know, he's got pilots that he can talk to. He's got experiences where he's flying. But until he's done with his driver's license, he's not going to enter into flight school. And he's also worried about taking on flight school and, you know, doing all these classes
exactly.
for high school.
Right. Oh, that's perfect. So you actually pivoted it directly to where I wanted to go next. So one of the things that I think might benefit the two of you while you're envisioning this high school experience, there are two properties of what I talk about in this notion of quote unquote enchanting an education. There are four key ideas, surprise, mystery, risk, and adventure. I typically recommend focusing on these ideas of surprise and mystery, especially with young children, but it is risk and adventure that seem to appeal the most to teenagers. And so
I wonder why.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And maybe don't appeal as much to their parents who are hand wringing, you know, nails on the edge of the wall, holding on for dear life. But what I want to suggest to you is this. He has a really good aspiration that gives him that sense of risk and adventure. And you've done such a good job of facilitating his dream while in these bite-sized chunks. You know, he's not ready to pilot a plane alone, but you've figured out how to give him the flight experiences that keep nourishing his imagination for the future. And because of that focus, he's even been able to borrow from his happy energy to work on subjects he's less interested in. One of the things I want to underscore, because it's such a fabulous example to those listening, is that a lot of times we want our kids to have what I'd call delayed gratification, right? We say, work hard, and then we'll figure out what you want to do with your life. Or work hard, that'll get you to college, which will then get you to your career. And what you've done is you've sort of reverse engineered. You've given him already a taste of the thing he really wants. And that happiness, that imagined future is compelling enough to help him stick to some of the requirements for education that are a less satisfying, less stimulating part of his life. And so it's important for us to always remember that we can nourish the hard part of life by giving our children a happy experience, not just by telling them someday in the future they'll be happy. So I want to commend you, Karen, because I feel like you already have a good, strong sense of how this works. But when we're looking at the traditional school subjects, the requirements for college, a charter school in California, it is easy to feel like you are robbing your homeschool of that nourishing, happy, exploratory energy you were used to when your child was young. So I wrote down three ideas that I wanted you to consider as you are planning this upcoming three more years. First of all, I love that you're including community college. There is something about academic adventure that we sometimes forget, and that is this. School or education taught by a mother for the entire lifespan of a child sometimes loses the feeling of adventure for the child. Because especially with you, where you have one child and there's a mother and child only, it can start to feel like they aren't being challenged. You know, who else are they competing against? Who else is evaluating them? They are at the stage where they're wanting to test their wings and find out, test their wings, how perfect for your son, and to find out how they stack up, right? Will another right. teacher think that they're a good writer? Will their peer group match their skill set? So good job with community college. The second thing then I want to ask you about is which subjects right now are the most irksome? Which are the ones Elijah is the least interested in?
This semester in particular, I've had him do history out of a textbook and he's not enjoying it. He is pulling ideas from it and I still offer videos. You know, we're doing some U.S. history. I'm offering things like, you know, the founding brothers and, you know, we're having conversations about the Constitution and watching videos about that and bringing in other sources, biographies about, you know, some of the founding fathers and things. And so I'm still layering on like I usually do, but it's much more driven by the textbook. And that's really not as fun. So for next year, I need to do maybe something a little bit different. But I was trying to fill in those holes. You know, we've done cycles of history over time, Yes. But really the last time he, you know, he delved into the American Revolution and the founding of our country was a long time ago, or at least seen through much younger eyes. And so I'm not sure how to bring that excitement back with a textbook, or, you know, but how to also fill in those little gaps. Like we'd never looked at the nullification crisis before. And he's actually writing for his Brave Writer research and citation class right now on the nullification crisis.
Nice.
And that's something I would have skipped over. But because he's reading the textbook, he hit it and then found it fascinating that it relates to states' rights, and wow, how many states' rights, it's still an issue after, you know, all this time. And so there's still things that are alive. It's just not as fun.
So this is brilliant. Perfect example. So let's talk a minute about history. I remember when Katrin was coming up to high school and we were trying to find ways to engage her in the story of history. She had no interest in textbook style history. Johanna, my other daughter, same similar thing. But by Katrin, I had learned a lesson, and that was we didn't use textbooks. We instead, I looked for that key into the subject area. So let me put it this way. We have a principle that I share sometimes in Brave Writer called everything can be taught through anything. So what you want to do is what you just discovered. Your son discovered the nullification crisis, which is going to illuminate all the aspects of U.S. government and early founding of America, because he now has a key to unlock that door. What we typically do is we decide to go chronologically or globally or generally. We say, well, here are the five things we want to teach, and we organize around those five things, and we move through it at sort of a plodding, predictable pace. What happened with Katrin is she got interested in the story of women in American history. So we came at American history through that story. And it was amazing how just laser focusing on women's rights in American history illuminated all the rest of history. It showed up not only in just suffrage, which wasn't until the 20th century, but it showed up in property rights and why women weren't included in the founding and what was education for women and what was the role of the founding fathers' wives. We purchased a book that was letters written by American women in history and got very caught up in the letters by Abigail Adams and her relationship to John. These were ways that we keyed into American history, but we used this sort of laser focus on the aspect of history that interested in her. Part of the reason I knew this worked is that I was a history major in college. And one of the ways I wrote my papers was I always tweaked the assignment to the aspect of history that was most interesting to me. And at the time I was in college, what interested me most wasn't, you know, weapons, treaties, war decisions. Here I was, a history major. Those didn't interest me. I was interested in social movements, in justice, in the revolution of what it meant to go from being a group of people who were, you know, maybe in a tribal kind of environment to civilizing. I was interested in the trends, the patterns of human beings and how they develop civilization. So whenever I had a paper to write, I was going to look for that angle. And that's what you are finding with your son. One of the things I was going to suggest even was, as a pilot, even understanding, you know, with this aspiration of being a pilot, understanding sort of the trajectory of history through the story, not just of aviation, but of transportation, telecommunications, all the ways that we have shrunken the globe through those technologies, because literally that's the story he's joining. That's the one. How, you know, aviation changed war forever. I mean, these are keys back into the story. So if you can liberate yourself from feeling like you have to quote unquote cover it all and allow your child to start finding that key that turns the lock for him, you may find that it all gets delivered back to you. It just won't be in the package of the textbook.
Well, this is what we used to do. And this semester, we're trying a textbook. So the experiment this semester failed is what it is, except for this piece about the nullification crisis. And that's what we've always done. You know, we've explored history through aviation and covered a lot of things in the 1900s. He wanted to study this year. I said, you know, what do you want to know? That's our question every year. And he wanted to know about the Dust Bowl. I gave him some ideas that we hadn't covered, and he wanted to know about the Dust Bowl. And so we registered for the Grapes of Wrath class. We went to the Steinbeck National Center, you know, museum. We took a tour through Salinas. We read Esperanza Rising, which is another book. We looked at Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta and all of the migrant workers, because that's a very California story, in addition to a national story. And then we studied the Dust Bowl, and we studied photographers around the Dust Bowl, because kept running across, you know, all these great images by, Horace Bristol and Dorothea Lange. And, you know, so, you know, we did all of these. It was very rich. And that's usually how we do history. And I also am having him read this textbook, which is a fail.
Well, isn't that great to find out, though? Because there is always this nagging sense that if you do it in this other way, you're missing something. But ironically, in my view, textbooks often feel like the ultimate missing of the information, because our eyes glaze over. We can't hold on to it. There is no meaningful interconnection. You know, the science of relations that Charlotte Mason talks about. We're too busy trying to cover information. Now, here's where the textbook may be useful to you, though, Karen. And I know the temptation, or I don't even want to call it that, the desire to have a spine, to have a text. I was a nut about making lists of what most kids covered in each of the grade levels. I did this all the time. It started in first grade. I think there was a series by Edie Hirsch called What Every First Grader Should Know, What Every Second Grader Should Know. Yeah. Remember those books?
And I do.
And that was before the internet. Once I got the internet, imagine how much more fun I had looking up lists. They were everywhere. But what I would do is I would digest the list. I would allow myself to be reminded, oh yeah, Yankee Doodle Dandy, we should sing that song. Oh yeah, they made corn pone in a, you know, cast iron skillet in the Civil War. We could do that. Oh, it is important, like you just discovered, to read the nullification clause or whatever sort of grabs you. I would just fill myself with what most kids were, quote unquote, being exposed to. And then we would just ignore it, pursue what our children were interested in, and then I would return to my lists and see if any of those ideas fit in or if there was anything that we had just really missed because it seemed important to include it. And we would attack it that way. So a textbook in high school, what it does for you is it reminds you of what you will forget. I couldn't teach history, even as a history major, without somebody reminding me, you know, of the major bills and laws and wars and statutes that run our country and impact the world. Those are not at my fingertips. But once I see what they are, there's so many other ways to help my kid connect to them. So I think you're really on the right track. I really love what you did for the Dust Bowl. Let me just say this. The depth of experience in the Dust Bowl becomes the lesson. It's not the Dust Bowl itself. There are people listening right now who are having a panic attack saying, I never taught the Dust Bowl. That is happening right now. I know it. That wasn't the point of teaching the Dust Bowl. What you taught your child is how to thoroughly investigate and understand and know an aspect of history, to think like a historian, to explore like a student of history. When you wrote to me and you mentioned that when your son, I want to read this to you. My favorite moment was at the end of a day when we went through a bookshop and saw so many great books by Steinbeck and others. This is when you visited the National Steinbeck Center. Many of these we knew, but there were others that we hadn't even known existed. When I came up for air, I turned to see Elijah tucked, sitting in a corner of the store, on the floor, under a rack of Steinbeck t-shirts hanging on a wall, reading. He had found a new twist novel by Steinbeck and was engrossed. Bombs away. The rest of the bookstore had disappeared and he was caught. Yes, I bought him the book. That's education. That's the study of history. So even if the textbook introduced the concept, it is the moment when your child is caught that he is being taught. When Jacob was in high school, he asked to go to public school. Many people know that story. And at the time, thought that homeschool was somehow failing him, which is why he wanted to go to high school. He had all these friends on sports teams, and he was a high-achieving kind of kid, and he wanted to measure himself against his peer group. His senior year of high school, he had to write a paper on Faulkner, and I was teaching at Xavier at the time and gave him my library card, and he went into the stacks, pulled down all these books about Faulkner, and when he got home, he said to me, "Mom, I now know why you wanted to homeschool me. I realized while I sat on the floor around all those books that I wanted to take as much time as I needed to read them all and write a really good paper, but I only had a week because I had a due date. Is that why you homeschooled me?" I was like, dude, it was.
Ding, 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 ding.
You get it now. So by the time my next kids came along, and as we were pursuing these various pieces of education, I used these strategies. One, I made lists of things that I wanted to pay attention to while we were in the study. And then I allowed my own intuition and sort of my brain, my unconscious, to work to bring together documentaries. You know, now I would look on Netflix if I could. We didn't have that then. Books that were written in first person. I remember Katrin read The Feminine Mystique when she was 12 years old. That's how deeply she was into feminism at the time. And that all came, yes, it all came from working on U.S. history through the lens of women's rights. The second thing that I want to recommend to you is if there is a subject that your child just isn't really that interested in. Let's say it's geometry or chemistry or some aspect of literature. Every student is different. Do a crash course. I did U.S. history with Johanna in 6 weeks. We got the SAT 2 book and we sat down on the couch and every day we read it and I lectured to her and we had a big juicy conversation. And then we pulled in a few accompanying ideas if they made sense, like an article online or a novel. And we crashed through it. And we did it in, it might've been 8 weeks, but it was a nightly thing that we did for about an hour. And then she took the SAT 2 test and got a good score. And that was it. And I counted that as a year's worth of credit because she actually did the work, but we did it in a crash course. And that worked for her. The thing to remember is all the stuff that we're teaching in high school, they're going to get it again in college, particularly if it's their field. So if they're interested in literature or history, they're going to go far deeper than we can in high school. We're just the introduction service, helping them discover what they might be interested in. And learning, you know, the foundation so that they're ready to apply themselves in college. Does that sound interesting? Have you ever thought of doing a short form sort of crash course?
No. So we, every year, you know, I ask the question, what do you want to learn? And then we dive into all those pieces. I make lists. I look up, if it's the Civil War, I look up the Civil War on Wiki and I go through and find all those fine points. And I, you know, grab a few great books and I read them and digest them and find out about them and then come up with documentaries and field trips and, you know, make sure women and minorities are covered. You know, there's something about government, cool articles or novels, you know, that
perfect.
I really relate to. But and then we spend a long leisurely year doing that. But the crash course is a new concept for me as an idea. And I really like that. I think that could be something that's useful if it's something that I feel like he needs to cover to do that in miniature. But still with intensity,
yes.
and a high level of challenge, that sounds great. That's new.
Awesome.
That's a new piece to take.
You know, when I was in high school, I was not good at math. And I found it very difficult to focus on math while I was being an actress in a play, on the drill team, on the tennis team, and all my other subjects that I loved. And so math suffered. And it occurred to me between my freshman and sophomore year of high school that if I isolated math, if I only took it in the summer and did it in 8 weeks, 4 hours a day, and it was the only thing I was doing, maybe I would have more success. So I signed up for geometry and did it in summer school and wound up with a B+, which for me was a huge triumph in math. And the crazy thing is, I look back on that summer and I actually enjoyed it because math wasn't competing with anything else. And so the only thing my brain had to work on was math. In fact, what's really funny to me when I look back on that year, one of my friends that year, her name was Toria, Vincent Price's daughter, actually, ironically, we were friends. We were in summer school together. And every day we would take the bus home and go play tennis after summer school. And I look back on that summer as really happy. She and I were really good friends. We got to play tennis every day. And I studied geometry and actually understood what I was learning. I think we sometimes forget that we are overloaded in all of these 7 classes together. And if we can give ourselves the opportunity to focus intensely and leave the other things aside for a shorter period, sort of that summer school model, then we give our kids an opportunity to even discover not only they can do it, but maybe even like it, because it isn't the thing that is draining energy from their happy life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. And I have a difficult time with this whole 7 classes in general.
Yes, totally. Totally. Well, that's the other thing with homeschool.
And that's why we've always homeschooled, right?
Yes.
And
you could certainly put your child on a totally different model too. You know, we've talked about this at other times in Brave Writer, where we tend to think the 7-hour day is the model. But what you could consider is, you know, we're going to do history in the fall, and then we're going to do, you know, science in the spring. And that's how we're doing it. We're not going to do history and science together. So we'll double up time on the fall for history and double up time for science in the spring. But these are alternatives that help break up the monotony. I think what we're always fighting in this 7-hour day is the feeling that we're chained to the hour per subject model. And we're really not.
Right. Well, even Charlotte Mason talks about, you know, doing less than that.
Absolutely.
I think, you know, especially with the little ones, you know, just the short lessons, that's always been appealing to me.
Shorter. And still true in high school, because the reason classes are an hour or 2 hours in classrooms across America is you're dealing with 30 students. And you have one teacher, and, you know, to get around the room during the dissection of the frog or the lab, or to make sure everyone has enough time to finish the math test so that even the straggler has adequate time, there's a lot of quote unquote wasted time. And my third idea for you was going to be to plan in some wasted time. You know, when you're on this sort of treadmill of getting, quote unquote, through a lot of subjects and you're a homeschooler, we tend to be far more conscientious than the school system. There tends to be this feeling where we can never leave anything half done, unfinished. We can't take a day off in the week or take a week off that isn't the scheduled recess. And yet the truth is, we do have that freedom. And sometimes just taking that break reinvigorates the regular routine that we're used to. So giving yourself permission to say, we're going to do, you know, in the fall, we'll do 5-day weeks. But when we get to winter and things start to get tedious, Friday is always going to be leave the house day. You know, we're going to ski, or we're going to go to the beach, or we're going to take the day to visit art museums, but we're going to do something not in the house. I think especially with an only child, this is very, very important, because the four walls can start to close in when their whole, you know, hormonal system is craving risk and adventure.
Yeah. Yeah. And we do, you know, we do love our poodle and our chickens, and we do try to get him out and walk him every day and that kind of thing to change the scenery. It is something to be, it's very intensive and also really lovely to be a mom of an only. And we do need to see other things and other people other than the four walls in our house.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I think, Karen, you have just a fabulous homeschool. I mean, it's more than apparent to me that your child is getting the education he deserves. One of the things to remember whenever you do start to feel that pressure of, oh no, I have to fulfill all these commitments, is to just pause and take notes in your scatterbook or in your notebook of all the amazing conversations and insights your child is offering you over the course of a week. Because then you will be reassured, oh, he knows how to learn, he is learning, and anything we miss, he's going to discover on his own in college or beyond. You know, there's no deadline. 18 is not the finish line, as you have proven in your own adult life. So you've given him a foundation, is very apparent to me.
Thank you. So with this idea of jotting down great things.
Yes.
Did you ever keep records of what your kids did?
I totally did. Yes, absolutely. The way that I did it, I've shared this in the Homeschool Alliance, which is my coaching community. I kept a notebook, but I called it a scatterbook because I'm kind of a scattered personality. So, you know, I'm not good at like systems. I can't say, okay, well, here are the four categories I'm going to need. That is not how I work. I tend to get it all down and then later reorganize it in my own thinking or mind. So what I would do is I made lists of books. I made lists of criteria. I made lists of movies, things that we had seen and done. But then I also jotted down direct quotes. Like if my kids said something brilliant or surprised me or shocked me, I also would take a day and I would write a narrative sketch of that entire day. Like what we did, what they said, what we enjoyed together, what new insights they offered, even what things they didn't like. What things didn't work, what failed. And I called these narrative sketches. And at one point, I kept them in a private blog. That blog is still online, but it is literally secret. No one has ever seen it except for me. But it was back when blogging was really brand new and popular. And I loved pairing pictures and doing formatting. It was almost like having a visual scrapbook of my children's homeschool. And those tools helped me feel like we were making progress better than any checklist, because I could go back and I reread them even today. And I am stunned by how much we did. Things I've completely forgotten. Like I thought that we had never read Plutarch's Lives. Apparently we did.
So glad it made an impression.
Well, how about that, right? We read it. I wrote about it. I completely forgot it. So there's a good example of feeling like, well, you know, Charlotte Mason said to do it. We did it and it didn't even stick. So, you know, some of this is all about becoming comfortable with what the nature of learning is. We aren't learning to amass information. We're learning how to learn. We're learning how to become self-educated, motivated citizens. That's what we're doing. And homeschooling provides that foundation, and it's clear listening to you that you have provided it. So let's just review real quick. I would say this then. Let's consider the idea of researching through a textbook rather than depending on it, you know, getting that list going. So number one, getting that list going of things that you want to stay aware of, things you could introduce that you've forgotten about in a particular school subject, and building from that, using the textbook the way you used Wikipedia, basically.
Yeah.
Number two, consider a crash course, doing something that is less pleasurable in a shorter time frame where you devote full energy to that. You literally push the pause button on other subjects and you just say, okay, we're going to do a crash course in this, get it done, feel like we've accomplished something, maybe not to the level of other school subjects, but enough to feel good about giving credit for a college application. And then number three would simply be keeping track of your child's development through this scatterbook idea, through taking notes, being involved in their story, making sure that you are paying attention to those developments.
I use a blank notebook. It's a regular sketchbook.
Perfect.
And I do, you know, keep those ideas at the beginning of the year. I keep what Elijah's interested in so that I always have that in the forefront and can come back to what he wants and what I think would be a rich you know, filling out, like I said, he was interested in the Civil War, but I didn't want him to just only do the Civil War. Of course, I wanted to cover some of the other things in the 1800s, you know, what was going on with slavery, what was going on with women, what was going on, you know, on the national stage, what was going on in California specifically. And so I'd fill all those things in with ideas and, you know, documentary book ideas, that kind of thing.
Right.
And then I'd come back and I used to do it through letters. You know, when people would ask, you know, what's going on, I used to do a holiday letter, but only to the, you know, close friends, whatever. And then I'd edit it down so that other people could tolerate it. Because otherwise it would be too long. But that's how I started. When he was little, it would be a letter kind of to myself or to other people or to him about what we had been doing. And then eventually in the last couple of years, it's more like a bullet list of some of the things that he's done. But what I love is this idea of direct quotes, which I only did when he was first very learning to talk. You know, I would keep the quotes of the little things he would say, and that was, you know, melt your heart kind of stuff. But I just love it as his young adult voice coming through to add quotes to my sketchbooks. And I love this sketch of the day. I think in one of the Waldorf programs we did, like a parent taught program when he was little, they had parents be observers of their children and just sit back and jot down what their child was actually doing. And it was so informative.
It's incredible how different that is than grading coursework. You get this 360 degree view of your child. This three-dimensional person shows up and it's reassuring. You know, so even if you have a child struggling in a subject area, you will get insights into that struggle when you just observe and take notes as opposed to only thinking about outcomes. And that's a major shift for homeschoolers. You know, we have to move away from that sort of scope and sequence graded mentality. In high school, oh my gosh, it just brings that craving back into focus. We're like, okay, well, I was able to avoid schoolish notions through eighth grade, but now I'm in real, you know, school. It's ninth through 12th grade. It can't be the same as before. But why not? Why can't we quote our young adults who are saying amazing things, you know?
Yeah. And what a gift. I would have loved to have had some of those from when I was idealistic and excited and
so true,
you know, discovering who I was, to have some of those things to come back to when I, you know, get bogged down with things like whatever's going on in life. And I use a journal to do that for myself now, but I would have loved to have that vision of myself as a young adult and a teenager. I think that would have been really lovely to be able to go back to, as you know, as I was trying to figure myself out. And so to be able to do that and have that for him sounds really great.
Awesome. That's fantastic. Well, I think this has been just a wonderful conversation, and I know it's going to help a lot of parents who are facing these similar dilemmas. So I thank you, Karen, for offering your story and your son. Would you be comfortable with us calling you back sometime in the fall and just checking in and seeing how these ideas are playing out for you?
Absolutely. That would be great and hold me accountable, and I would love it.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
While we step away from Karen for a moment, I want to take a chance to read to you another quote from my brand new book, The Brave Learner, Finding Everyday Magic in Homeschool, Learning, and Life. Today's quote is coming from a chapter where we talk about the value of risk in learning experiences. And just like we've been discussing with Karen, teens are the most inclined to being excited about risk and adventure. Sometimes we think about risk like aviation, right? Getting a pilot's license or driving a car. But what about risky thinking? Here's what I have to say about that topic in The Brave Learner. Dare to think differently. In addition to bold, daring activities, make space for risky thinking. New insight bubbles up. Choose to sit with ideas in conflict. For children, the way my family does it is the right way. By high school, teens notice alternatives. For instance, consider how many ways there are to eat. The way my family eats, the way my kosher-keeping neighbors eat, the way people eat in China, the way my cousin with Crohn's disease eats. These variations of what we all do form a base of difference within similarity. Risk means being willing to entertain those differences without collapsing in fear or anxiety. We can't get there if the only method of education is one that values our right answers arrived at by thinkers we approve. In The Brave Learner, I give you ideas for how to grow your own capacity for risk, being willing, for instance, for your children to challenge your assumptions. And isn't that the hardest kind of conversation? The one where your child holds a position, holds forth on a position that you don't hold? Absolutely, I have been there. But just know this, you are helping your child grow their cognitive powers every time they think outside the family culture or outside the boxes that you want them to check. They won't hold all these positions in their absolute form all the way into their 40s and 50s, I promise you. But by allowing them that space and creating room for a difference of opinion, you are teaching them how to be critical thinkers. So kudos to you if you're taking that risk with your family. If this kind of discussion, what we've been talking about in this podcast season, if the suggestions I make or the discussion points we're holding seem relevant to you, then I think you're going to love my book. But here's what I'm actually the most excited about. Once you have the book, I want to read it with you. I want to talk to you about it. I want to walk you through the various practices and activities in the book. Here's how we're going to do it. I will be hosting a monthly book club webinar available live and on replay. And the very first session, the very first meeting of our Brave Learner Book Club is for anyone who pre-orders the book, totally free. If you live in a foreign part of the world from me, I'm in Cincinnati, let's say you're in Bangkok, yes, it will be at an inconvenient hour for you. So what we will do is make that replay available to you at any time. Here's the goal though. I want us to convene. I want to hear from you. I want to know what's working, what's not, how we can tweak and twist these activities to be truly meaningful in your families. And I want us to revolutionize the conversation about learning at home. I want us to feel comfortable considering all the options and creating a truly meaningful experience for you and your family. So if you're interested in that, if you want to be a part of this educational revolution, go to thebravelearner.com and click on any of the buy buttons. You can buy the book in Audible, Kindle, or paperback. Any purchase counts. You can buy it for a friend and then come back and enter your receipt number on the link provided there. You add that plus your email address or your friend's email address, and we will send you two free gifts. One of which is a PDF download called Hard Cases, Q&A with Julie, where I address some of the pesky questions I've gotten over the last 20 years. And then the other is an invitation to that webinar. Both of these will come to you on February 5th when the book is published. So I'm very much looking forward to participating with you on this journey. And I thank you for your enthusiasm up to this point. And let's get back to Karen, because I can't wait to find out what happens with this aviation-loving son of hers. Welcome, Karen. We're so glad to have you back on the podcast for this follow-up conversation.
Thanks for having me, Julie.
It's just great to talk with you. And I just want to refresh everyone's mind that you are talking about how to create a balanced high school life. Do you want to expound on that just for a moment, a little bit more?
Well, I was having a difficult time trying to juggle the charter school requirements, you know, the minimum high school requirements, the community college classes that my son's taking, and what used to be a pretty relaxed, lovely homeschooling yes. experience. And it feels like the ante's just really gone up. There's a lot more to do. There are a lot more things to juggle in order to meet requirements outside of our home and homeschooling. And so, you know, trying to bring some sanity, really, and balance to that is my goal.
Completely makes sense. I understand that experience. I know that high school poses for many people what I like to call the re-upping moment, where, you know, you signed on at kindergarten with a lot of confidence, but then suddenly high school feels daunting all over again, and you have chosen to re-up. So let's just discuss a little bit about the homework I gave you. Some of the things that we suggested were being able to make lists of the most important things you want him to learn, how to integrate those with interests, hobbies, and passions, ways to look at doing a crash course if it's a subject that you don't really see him showing as much interest in. Did any of those help you plan? How are they working for you so far?
So it was really helpful to go back to one of the things you said in, you know, I do, you have a scatterbook, I think, and I use a sketchbook.
Yes.
And to add some of his voice into that as I plan was really helpful. That was one of the suggestions that you had made, not just to think about what I'm doing, but and what he wants, but really add his voice. So as an observer, look at where he is in this moment and what he's needing and bring his voice into that conversation. Actually write it down. You know, I hear it all the time. I transcribe things, but to really use his quotes was helpful to come back to kind of the foundation of what he's needing as I plan. So that worked really well. I think we're doing a pretty good job of bringing in hobbies and interests. So that was nice to just kind of check and say, yes, you know, I'm doing something that's working.
What are some of those hobbies and interests that he is enjoying simultaneous to this more academic project?
So he really wants to be a pilot. And so, you know, a lot of what we do academically will be focusing on his need to have a degree
yes.
To really land a job. So he's happy to do the schooling because he wants to be a pilot, and doesn't mean he's got it all figured out yet, which, you know, at 15, of course.
Right.
But integrating the hobbies, like doing a Young Eagles program, they meet once a month. They're in most major cities where kids get to go and have a first flight experience. Pilots volunteer their plane and their time and their fuel to be able to give kids the experience of flight. And you can go really as many times as you want. So he's been volunteering there and also getting flights there and learning a lot about scholarships that are available and camps that are available and programs for kids who want to be pilots. And so it's been a real positive to be able to do that and participate in that program. So so adding that in has been great. Through that program, he found out about something that's a Sporty's Learn to Fly course online. So he was able to do some kind of ground school training online over the summer.
That. Oh, that's so good.
Yeah, which was great. And then when he finished that course, he was able to get a free full flight lesson from a flight instructor at a local airport. So he just did that last week. You know, so we're definitely layering those things in so that his desire to be a pilot and that goal really moves him forward academically as well.
You know what I'm hearing and what I think is so brilliant? You know, he is learning some of those disciplines that we think the academics are going to teach through this aviation journey. So following through on an entire course online, showing up on time, being coached or taught by an expert. These are all the things that we expect our kids to learn either in a public high school or bachelor's in college. And we assume that it needs to be like a history class or a math class. And yet the very skills that he needs to learn, whatever he needs to learn in life, he's getting a first crack at it with something he cares about. And so I love how you have shown him sort of the 360 degree view of what it means to be a pilot. He not only gets to have these bite-sized experiences that keep that alive in his imagination, but he's even having to employ some student-like skills to pursue mm-hmm. his passion, and then you can borrow those right into the academics that will enable him to go to college. So I love what you're doing. Do you see it that way too? Is that it's what you're
really
noticing?
I see it as a gift. You know, not everybody's kid knows what they want to do,
yes,
but most kids have some sort of interest. They're not always married together, the interest and a future career, but all those skills are really there. So that's, to me, what homeschooling is all about, are those skills that they gain, are the, you know, teaching in the sweet spot kind of moments, are following your passions so that you can be a real human, you know, a full human being,
right,
not just the automaton that's, you know, checking the clock or, you know, checking off something from a list of things that you're supposed to be getting done, you know, for a class. So yeah, absolutely.
So tell me a little bit then about your plans for the academics and how that may be shifted after our conversation.
So our family has shifted a little bit, and it may be that sometime in the next year I need to be working at least part-time. So what I tried to do is up the academics a little bit this semester.
Yes.
So that we could check off some of those boxes and then have a little bit less to do maybe while I'm working. So the crash course idea was really important.
Awesome.
That could not have come at a better time. It's really hard though to take a full curriculum and squeeze it into something shorter, smaller time-wise. But it's been important to break things down. You know, I've had to take a couple of different things and break them down this semester into smaller chunks of time to really hit it as deeply as possible in the shorter amount of time, but to then check off the box, because sometimes that still has to happen. And so the crash course planning has been, I think, harder than regular planning, because there isn't the, you know, I often make like a general sketch of something. I choose books and resources. Then I choose kind of something to make a routine, a rhythm for the day or the week, and then we
right.
just go. But this has really had to be so much more specific so that I'm sure to get everything in to 6 or 8 weeks.
Yes, right. It's almost like you're teaching on the quarter system
quarter
for
system.
College.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. It moves at such a much faster pace.
So that has been harder.
Understood.
Than I had anticipated. And at times it felt like, you know, I'm just done. I just want to be done, but I can't be done, because if I'm going to do this in 6 or 8 weeks, I have to keep going.
Well, I totally get that. And of course, always feel free to experiment. Maybe you need to do 3 weeks on, a week off, 3 weeks on. You know, it can still be in a short time frame, but if it feels overwhelming to take on that many weeks simultaneously or consecutively, I guess is the way we want to put it,
yeah.
Give yourself permission to take a break. One of the things that is a lens to help you with this is if you front load the year with these bigger challenges, when you have your fresh fall energy, then
That's
you
exactly.
get to, yes, exactly. Then you get to sort of slough off. So if you do this 6 weeks and you're sort of like counting it down and it feels intense, definitely give yourself a nice break when that's over and know that you can shift into a different kind of energy following it. Because you can't just do back to back to back to back crash courses. That will be exhausting for
right.
everybody. Yeah.
Right. 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 Yeah. So I like the option of having, you know, a few weeks of this and then a few weeks of that, which may end up happening. But I also know that I am front loading.
Yes.
You know, it's... It's crunch time for other reasons. So front loading makes sense and it needs to happen. So this semester is when it's going to happen. And if that's going to be, you know, 6 to 8 week chunks, a couple different times, or if that's going to be, you know, probably 4 week chunks
yeah.
and then shift
yes.
To something else, then that'll be the way it happens. But it needs to happen or it may not happen at all. So
right, right. Well, that's what I used to realize. I mean, it took me several years to discover that our best projects happened in the fall. And so once I figured that out in the first couple years, then I always made sure that fall was loaded with the things that I was the most excited to do that were going to require the biggest amount of energy from me and the kids. And there were always projects like that. I mean, we didn't even have Instagram or Facebook back then, and I still had more projects that I wanted to try than time to experience, right? So I tried
to Pinterest.
Right. I mean, all of those, exactly. You know, and then you consult with people at park days, and then you go to your charter school teacher and she has a list of things. So picking 2, 3, 4 of those and really doing them at the beginning of the year allows you to move into a different energy by the winter. I wanted to ask you about your son. How's he feeling? What is his feeling about school this year, and how is he responding to the idea of a crash course or some of these ideas that you're testing?
It's week 3, so he's still adjusting to the new schedule. He ended up with a canceled class, and so he's done at 9, and then you know, we're trying to accommodate his desire to sleep and give him a little rest in the morning, but sometimes his body clock is waking him up. So I think his biggest issue right now is just adjusting to being back to a full schedule, also the newness of having a class in the evening, that doesn't give the usual, what used to be, downtime in the evening. And so now we're, you know, we're kind of flip-flopping lots of things. So I think that's his biggest issue. He loves that we're doing as much as we're doing with, definitely with hobbies. The crash course idea, he's like, is that allowed?
Isn't that amazing? And then you say, yes, it so is.
Yes.
I love that.
And we're exploring some different things. You know, some of the work samples that we got from the charter school, he looked at and said, I'm just not doing these. These are not great quality.
Isn't that amazing?
And I said, well, this is the reason why a crash course works. You know, we like to do deep dives. We like to be really thorough.
Yeah.
When we're passionate about something, we explore it and explore it and explore it, you know, to no end. But there's a limited amount of time. So this is how we're going to do it. And, you know, he said, okay. So
that's right. And you never know, you know, sometimes they get interested halfway through a brief encounter too, because you're giving it that devoted attention that normally gets spread out and dissipates. So you're almost giving it a full chance when you do it in a more intense way, if that makes sense. Yeah. And you never know, they may circle back in college or later in life. You know, there are plenty of kids who don't like history, plenty of adults who didn't like history, and then they hit 35 and all they care about is history, you know, because a couple decades under your belt and suddenly it's very interesting to understand what happened before. So we're also planting seeds that can maybe spring to life through another venue later. So that's perfect. Well, wonderful. Yeah,
and he would like to the time. You know, I think one of the things that I found is that I could have been a perpetual college student. Because there was so, you know, there was just, it's like the whole Pinterest Instagram thing. You know, there's just, ooh, you mean there's something else?
Right.
Ooh, that whole discipline looks interesting. You know, so there just wasn't enough time for that. And I think that's part of the life experience is figuring out what to weed out as well.
Yep.
And so that feels like an important piece to be introducing at this point, because we've spent so much of our time being able to do those deep dives, and he really thrives doing them, but it's not possible to do that for everything.
Yes.
And it's not possible to do that. You know, he sees me making choices about curriculum, and he sees me making choices about, you know, social engagements and things. You know, we can only do so many things. So he's starting to take that on as well. And I think that paring down is a skill that not everybody has and is still important to cultivate.
Yes, because part of what you're teaching him is how to be the voice of his own home education, of his own education. And I love that that's where you started with this follow-up call, and I wanted to draw it back full circle. What we're doing isn't just down in the weeds of what the coursework is. We are also helping our kids discover how to be in charge of their own learning odyssey, which will last for the rest of their lives. It isn't limited just to the years when they're getting degrees. And so by showing them a variety of ways to learn things, what kind of student they are, what kind of schedule they need, what kind of balance between hobbies and requirement or obligation to a job or to some other task, we are giving them all these experiences so they can develop their own educational voice. They can actually be self-aware human beings who knows what works for them. And so I am impressed with what you're doing. I feel like you've really just taken this ball and run with it.
It's been great.
Karen, thank you so much for being on today's podcast and helping other families of high schoolers think differently about how to combine their interests in academics.
Thank you so much for your help, Julie. This has been fantastic.
Wonderful. Take good care.
Thank you.
Thanks to Karen for laying out such a common concern in homeschool. I think Karen and her son give us a model of what it means to scrap credits and also deep dive into our passions, into what we love, to create an amazing high school experience. So thank you for that. I'm hopeful that that was helpful to everybody listening. If you aren't following me on Instagram yet, I hope you will. My account is at Julie Bravewriter. And every week we discuss these episodes in the comments based on whatever the topic was. So just a couple weeks ago, we talked about how to add fun to learning, which was a hugely popular episode. We had so many people sending us Instagram stories and posts sharing about why that episode was so meaningful. Julie, who has an account called Julie Is Probably Already Taken, had the following comment, and I wanted to pass along her great suggestion. This was such a great episode. I wanted to recommend a tool for capturing her son's writing in a paragraph. Google Docs has a pretty great speech-to-text tool. Her little guy might love the process of talking to the computer and watching his words pop up on the screen. So isn't that fun? And so if you have a child who is struggling with writing and isn't quite ready to transcribe their own thoughts, but doesn't really want you to jot them down either, this is a great option for you. And I appreciate that suggestion. We've also seen just a slew of you leaving reviews on iTunes. I cannot tell you how meaningful that is to our team. Every time you post one, it gets shared in our Slack channel and our podcasting team high-fives each other. It's just gratifying to know that this work we're doing, sending this out into the world just as an act of, you know, generosity and to encourage homeschooling parents, is being valued and received by you. So thank you for that. If you want to leave a review, please just go to iTunes or Stitcher and follow the directions. And we are deeply appreciative when you do. Thanks for listening today. I'd like to give credit to the podcast masters for doing an awesome job of audio editing and preparing the show notes. We do have transcriptions of all of the episodes coming and may even be posted by the time you're listening to this episode. So feel free to go back to blog.bravewriter.com, click on the podcast category, and you'll be able to find those transcripts if you would like to have a written copy of any of these conversations. They are graciously prepared by my wonderful daughter, Katrin Bogart. So let's give her a shout out. Also, a shout out to Beth, Jeanette, and Amy for making sure that these podcasts are ready to go every single week. And now I return you to your lovely family. Enjoy this season of loving and learning. I'm Julie Bogart from Brave Writer.